Hi, this is David Sweet, founder of Focus Core, and I'd like to invite you to take a look at our 2024 salary guide. It's a great resource for hiring APAC professionals wanting to know about the salaries for executive positions within Japan, as well as finding out information of what's important to attract the best talent in Japan. The salary guide is found on our website under About Salary Guide 2024. I hope you find this information useful for you and your company. Now, on to our podcast.
I sense much fear in you, young Skywalker.
Welcome to the Focus Core podcast. Today I am joined by Pascal Gebert Gallier. I totally butchered that, didn't I?
I think you did. It's the German stuff.
We started in German.
Welcome,
Pascal.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Pascal is country manager for SES IMID Magotag, and before that you're also an advisor for the bakery Gotran Scherer, and I probably butchered that as well, but boy, they have great croissants. Prior to joining SES Imagotag, he was the director for Biocibon, which was one of the largest European organic retail chains. They now went from zero to 27 stores within 4 years in Japan, which is absolutely fantastic. You've worked both here and in Asia, Middle East, Africa. I think I met you back in the day when you were at DM International, which you were doing pop-up displays for the luxury industry. And you started your career in the industrial sector. You've got many wonderful degrees. You're fluent in Japanese, Chinese, English, French. You're just a Renaissance man, and I'm always very happy to speak to you, Pascal. Welcome.
Thanks very much, David. I'm very happy to talk to you as well. And as you said, it's been a long time since we've known each other. But always good to be with friends.
So let's talk about your path to Japan. Kind of walk me through our listeners how you got here.
That's always the first question that foreigners ask each other, right? How long have you been in Japan, and what brought you to Japan? I was actually having that discussion this morning with the French Minister of Commerce, who was in Tokyo, and he was telling the whole audience that he loved Japan, and he was in Japan because of personal reasons. So I asked him, why did you come, and what sparked the interest? And he said, we probably are the same age, and I was watching anime and manga when I was a child, and I wanted to know more. And that's really what sparked his interest in Japan. And I think for a lot of people in our generation, it's either this, so the pop culture, or the martial arts, and or maybe for the French men, I would say, we are what we are, the Japanese, let's say, beauties would be one way or the other. And sometimes it's you start with one and you end up with the later, which is pretty much what I happen to have. So I started with martial arts. Actually, I got introduced to judo at a very young age, started at six. Then I got interested into Japan as a, let's say, teenager. And I wanted to know more about the country. Loved the pop culture. I loved the soft power that Japan was displaying at the time. And I decided that, to get to know the country better, I had to study Japanese and really come and try to see by myself. So when I entered university, I had the possibility to start learning, and I first came over more than 20 years ago, 2002 was my first trip to Japan, and the rest is history, as I say.
Nice. So I'm going to start you off with a more difficult question with a sharper question. Have you ever chopped anyone in half?
Yes, in my mind, certainly. But I try to limit myself to tatami mats these days. It's safer for everyone, clearly, and provides the same benefit of stress release, I would say. But you're mentioning to my practice of the Japanese art of fencing, which is kenjutsu, and especially so what the area I'm practicing, which is Batodo, which is the art of cutting. And yes, we do not chop anybody. We only chop usually either bamboos or rolled tatami mats. But it's similarly hard, I would say. And it's a great stress reliever because you need to be very careful. Obviously, the Japanese swords, the katana, everybody knows about it. In the films, everybody, you know, has phantasms or fantasies about what this is about. But, you know, it's just a sharp blade. So you have to be careful, mindful of your surroundings, of what you're doing. And it's just another martial arts. So you're focusing on improving yourself. Concentrating, making yourself a better person. So that's really the core of it right now.
So how did you get into kenjutsu?
It's an evolution. As I said, I started with judo. I did some karate after that. Kept going with jiu-jitsu. And as I was getting older, I was always fascinated by the samurai culture. And, you know, there's a saying that when you're ready, the teacher appears. And it's pretty much what happened. So contact a friend of mine through our daughters, actually, at school. We got in touch. And, you know, I just learned that he was practicing. He's a black belt now. He's fifth, 6'10". And, you know, I said, yeah, I'm doing this. And a small group, with our sensei, we're 10. Why don't you come over? So that was 3 years ago now.
Wow.
And that was mind blowing. That's really what I wanted to do. So unfortunately, I don't have much time.
Yeah. In what way was it mind blowing?
Because you're thrown back a few centuries. Basically, you don't usually see people walking around with swords anymore, right? Since the 1870s in Japan, mm-hmm. and seeing even for the Japanese, you don't have that many people. Really practicing these days. It's quite confidential. And yeah, it would spark images of, as you were saying, are you cutting people in half? Is this person dangerous? What are you doing on the street when you're walking around with your katana? And don't worry, this is peaceful. We are peaceful warriors. but it can, you know, it's if you start with on the wrong foot, you can have a wrong image. So the key is really self-improvement. It's quite technical, and the interesting thing is you're spending a whole lot of time to try to be natural. And mm-hmm. when you do your first cut, the first time you touch a katana, you will do your first cut very cleanly. Everybody can do it, and then the mind starts, you know, thinking, overthinking, and then it gets complicated, and you spend a whole life trying to come back to what you first had. It's just like the babies can do it, but then after that, you make things complicated. And I think in life and business, it's the same. You start walking, you don't think about it, and then when you start overthinking, there are lots of problems happen. So same fight in life as well as in Batodo. Go back to the roots, go back to the natural movement.
I got my first on in karate, and I found that it does impact how you work and that kind of mental resilience. It slows things down, and then just doing kata also helps in just the practice, the repetition to get ready for. Because I really liked fighting. I liked doing tournaments and such. But when I was watching you cut into a tatami, it's very quick. It's very smooth. It's just one action. It's very zen.
It is. It's one cut, one kill, basically. which is also one stroke, one word, basically. So you will see that across a lot of disciplines. I think in Japan, pay attention very much to the Japanese spirit, right? Mm-hmm. And we also do kata. And I think to understand the Japanese psyche, it's quite important. It's just like you have to learn the rules. The kata is the form, right? So you have to first learn the form. You have to be within the mold.
Yeah.
And then learn your place, basically, learn the rules. And then slowly as you progress, as you master your craft, then you can start bending the rules. And then when you really reach mastership level, you can start breaking the rules and then make them your own. And that's, I mean, the late, very, very late stage. And I think in life, in business, in those arts, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. If you want to start in a Japanese environment, I mean, our listeners are business-minded people. If you want to do business in Japan as a foreigner, if you come in and you want to crash and destroy the rules and everything, you're not going to last very long. You have to adapt to the set of things, and then slowly by slowly you start making changes. But you're not going to do the revolution. You don't hold the truth. People have been there. The environment is different. So you need first to learn that. And then after that, yes, start making changes slowly but surely. And then at the end of the day, yes, you can break the rules, but first learn the rules. Yeah. It should be more successful in the long run. It takes time. So you have to have the right mindset. You have to be willing to make efforts. But I think it might be a little bit more visible in Japan, but it's pretty much the same everywhere.
Yeah. It's learning that craft. And then finding the freedom within a craft.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the blade you use, now you have a Nanbokucho blade. Talk about that.
Yes. So I have a small collection, I would say. So as you may know, samurai were using different types of blades. So they had the katana, the long one. Oh. They had also the wakizashi, which is used to be the second blade, or the one you were using for self-protection within the confine of the houses, of the buildings, because you can't wield a long blade. So those were the two main ones, the daisho, long and short blades that the samurai were wielding. And sometimes they also had shorter ones, kind of a knife, which is called a tanto. So those are the three main blades, and they will be defined by the length. So less than 30 centimeters would be a tanto. Between 30 to 60 is a wakizashi, and over 60 is a katana. So I'm only using historic blades. And so I do have a tanto from a Kamakura Jidai, Kamakura period. So it dates back to 1100 year old, and the blade is in a pristine condition, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. And you can buy that, on Rakuten, on Yahoo for $1,000, kind of, if it's not assigned or, blade, etc. So it's not even that expensive when you think about it for a piece of history. And I've been using this for my cut. So the dealer went mad at me because tell me what you're doing with a historic blade. But it's been battle proven, battle hardened, battle tested. And yes, you can have very good modern blades. You still have about 100 swordsmiths in Japan, still producing to this day. Makes a different thing to connect, let's say, with a piece of history, which has been made in that case of my katana. It's about 1450, so more than 60, about 600 years ago. Yeah, very, very specific. The blade's shape changes with history. The Mongol invasions influenced the shape, because the Mongol armor was different than the Japanese armor. The peacetime during the Edo period, people were not fighting with armor anymore, so the blade got straighter, a bit longer. So before that, the main fighting method during the Kamakura period was on horse, so you have also deeper curve. The place of a curve on a blade is not the same, it's longer. And then those blades historic blade, sometimes they got shortened to fit with the times, and still got handed down, you know, the generations after generations, well protected. So it's there's a beauty. There is beauty in the steel. There is beauty in the sword. It's very technical. The process involved is not just on a craft, you know. It's just like almost priesthood in a way. There is a link with Shinto. There is a link with the religion. People were saying that the katana is the blade, and the blade is the soul of a samurai. So the ability to maintain it, the purity of it, the cleanness of it. There's a lot of cultural meaning embedded into this, and those are really, really beautiful, beautiful pieces of metalwork, frankly speaking.
Wow.
And that's why I think it's, you know, it's been conveyed and everybody in the world knows about katana. There's mystic around it, but the sheer beauty and the whole process coming into it is just far much more than a weapon. And that's also one of the reasons why in our practice, we're often very much invited to perform at the jinja, at the shrines, because there's this link with the Japanese culture. You know, the katanas, the tachis, were often sold, given as present to the shrines, because there's a way to cut through evil. You have a lot of you know, the Japanese katana cutting through evil, so the protection, the mamori katana, for example, is still something very much to this day. So when you have a daughter being born, some families would have a tanto, so a knife being forged for her, placed in a cradle to protect her and ward off all the evil spirits. So it's still present to this day. So there is a very deeply rooted tradition around the blade, the Japanese blade, which is still very much present.
Wow, what an awesome cultural background for you and context for diving into all that you do. Because I know we've talked a lot about offline about history, and we share a lot of that joy together. But I didn't realize how much that went into the culture, which is fantastic. And now you're the Japan country manager for SCS Imago Tag. So I'm switching from my bad French to bad German. I studied German, so I should be better at that. Imago
Tag. Imago Tag, yes.
Yes. Tell us about that.
Sure. So as I said, it's German, but actually Imago Tag was an Austrian company. And SCS sounds English, but actually it is. It's store electronic systems, but it was founded 30 years ago as a French company. So, you know, some French companies, even with our bad comment of English, are still trying to be international from the get-go. And I think there's some hope in the French tech somehow, especially with the young generation. But to put it simply, SCS Imago Tag, as I said, company founded 30 years ago, grew externally, internally, organic growth and external growth. What we're doing is, historically speaking, we've been the founder and inventor of the electronic shelf label. So ESL, what is an ESL? It's just a digital tag, which historically was only displaying price in supermarkets. Our founder was coming from a retailer, basically. His family was owning several different supermarkets in the north of France. And as a kid, he used to swap paper tags, you know, with the prices. And they had more than 6,000 SKUs, so storekeeping units, so single references. Took them forever to do that. He was counting there was roughly 1 minute per tag in order to do that correctly.
Yeah.
So multiplied it by 60,000.
Yeah,
60,000 minutes. That's an awful long time and cost. And so as a kid, he got really fed up with that. And so he ventured to find a way to try to automate these pricing changes. And that's how the company was founded, with that vision. 30 years down the road, we're now in a very different place. We just announced our financial results, 620 million euros, growth of 45% year on year. Which has been steady since the last 10 years. Why? Because what we do right now is a platform to digitize the physical store. So it's not only pricing automation, it's also everything which is linked to out of stock operational efficiency within the store, how to generate data, analyze that data, drive the staff to be more efficient at what they do, picking, stock counting, inventory management, and also using, because those are displays at the end of the day, using the displays to communicate with the client, having the brands deliver the message at the point of sale. So also for the customer being able to bridge the gap between the physical store and the experience they have on the e-commerce, being able to link through, for example, NFC, QR codes, new types of technology, to go and shop even within the store. Say, for example, you don't have, the product is out of stock. You scan the QR code on the tag, then boom, you're off onto the, on either the retail platform or the e-commerce, you can order the same, or you can know where the product is available at a nearby store, or what you can have. You can have also suggestions as to what kind of similar product you have. Or you can have, as we say in Japanese, the osusume, meaning, okay, if you bought that product, then you might be interested in this other product. So it's a whole new level of what we call, it's a little bit barbaric, but digital. So the bridge between physical and digital. And basically the equation is that the physical plus digital, 1 + 1 = 2. It's just how you can provide to the shopper a seamless experience between what he knows at the store, what he knows, online, and try to make the experience more enjoyable for them. Because at the end of the day, why would you go to a store if you can buy everything online? You have to provide something more. That was also what I was doing at Pio Sebo here, is if people can do the shopping online, then they need to get a little bit something out of coming to the store. It's the human touch. It's the learning experience. It's the discovery. It's the, intensity, maybe. It needs to be fun. It needs to be something different. That's why I think also in the retail environment in Japan, company like Don Quixote, for example, so Pan Pacific Holding, is crazy for by Western standards, because it's all over the place. It's all over the place, just like you go to the bazaar. You can't find your product, but you go on a weekend, you want to have fun. Yeah, let's go to Don Quixote. It's just like going to Disneyland. There's everything you want. Anywhere.
It reminds me, Don Quixote, now that you've talked about that, reminds me of a Japanese website. So you go to a Japanese website and it looks like Don Quixote. It's got everything on it. And you can find, you have to go through all the shelves to find out what you're looking for.
Exactly.
What do you find in bringing this into Japan? How do you find this different than rollout in Europe?
So Europe is pretty much advanced in terms of adoption of that technology. And actually has been a leader in driving it. So in the world, Europe is probably the far much advanced player, and especially France in that field, which has been our historic market. Then the Americas, and especially now the US since COVID, with the difficulty to get staff, the cost increase, inflation, pricing rotation, which are increasing, out of stocks, issues on supply chain. The need for such solutions has really, really been, it's needed more than ever. And everybody in the C-suite has realized that they have to do that. So within the last 2 years, we've seen Walmart adopt our solution. Actually, it's a solution we co-developed with them. Mm-hmm. So we are their exclusive supplier, and they're the number one in the world in terms of size. But then after that, everybody, Kroger, we're equipping some of the Amazon stores as well in the US. So everybody's jumping on the train, because they need that. You need to be more efficient. Retail is a very low profit margin kind of business. You're talking bottom line 1-3%. So with all those constraints arriving, it's just the perfect storm. Everything happening at the same time, all over the place. So you need to think out of the box and bring some new solutions. And those new solutions need to be close to what you could find in your everyday life with your your IT systems. So if you're an Android or Apple user, you think you want to have an ecosystem which is as easy to use as possible, plug and play. You don't want to go through books and books of manuals to try to understand how to operate your system. Just way past that. But that was what happened in Japan years ago with the club, how do you call that, the clapé, all the phones. I remember having my first iPhone. Where's the manual? There's no manual. Yeah. But for the Japanese phones, they were coming with a 400 pages kind of worth of manuals. Like, okay, it makes everything from SMS to short message to video to maybe making coffee. I don't know. I'm going to read about it because it's way too long. It's way too complicated. So that's what we tried to do. And having our systems really integrating seamlessly within the architecture at the store. So if you plug, we have partnership with Cisco, for example. If we bring our IoT device in the system, at the push of a button, basically everything is going to come online. Mm. So it has to be that easy, because otherwise you cannot ramp it up into a portfolio of several thousands. Even if you're thinking in Japan, in the convenience stores, you're talking tens of thousands of stores. It would take years if you were on legacy systems, which are requiring a local server, meaning you need to have people, train people to go to the deep end of Aomori, for example, to do cabling, to install the server, to put a program on that. And then after that, maintenance, it's crazy. So everything for us is cloud-based. Everything remotely operated. The HQ has full visibility, full control on what's happening. And that's basically how we've been able to equip some retail stores, retail chains in Europe, in the US. In the US, we had last year 3,500 stores installed within 6 months. With a mattress firm, which is crazy. I mean, took forever with the previous technology, but with the move to cloud, and with the second largest customer of Microsoft as of now for their cloud business.
Nice.
Can you believe it? And we're just at the very beginning of a story, so it's a revolution, frankly speaking. Not something that the customer sees very much yet in Japan, because Japan is lagging to some extent. In that end, I think our listeners who may not be Japan may have the image that Japan is a very, very technologically advanced society, which by some aspect is true. On the robotic side, on the AI side, a lot of very good technology, a lot of very, very high profile companies, the Nidex, Keyence, etc. But at the same time, it's totally a laggard in maintenance of systems developed in the 1970s. Everybody's talking about the digital cliff coming in 2025 when all these guys retire and there's nobody to operate the system. I mean, talk about some of the big banks last year having their ATM system crash like 8 times, not being able to withdraw one yen over one day, and 8 times in a year. That's crazy. How can you operate? It's not possible. So The move to something which is a totally brand new technology, so starting from a clean slate and building up instead of just doing the millefeuille, the layered approach, which has pretty much been the Japanese approach for the IT systems over the last 50 years. It's scary for them because they have to let go of all these systems, and you have all these embedded teams as well, worrying for their own situation. What's going to happen to us? So if we don't need anybody to operate the servers, etc., if we go cloudless, if we go on the cloud, what will become of us? So those are legitimate questions, and this needs to be approached. But what I can see right now is it's most of the systems being operated are not sustainable. Mm. Are not sustainable. Now when I was at Docebo, we're still getting with some of our suppliers requested fax
for wholesale,
and still very much a practice to this day. I mean, talk about fax to anybody anywhere outside of Japan, they look at you and say, you're crazy. And then we went on to digitize our ordering system, and they couldn't do email. So we had to do e-fax. why do you want to keep that? Right. But
talking to a client last week that's saying, still complaining about wholesalers wanting faxes. And
yeah.
But I think what I've seen is with what you're talking about, the customer will drive a lot of that change for you, because customers want the experience. For example, I want to do some shopping online. I want to compare stuff, but I want to go and try on my running shoes in the shop. Right. So then I want that experience, but then I want to come home and buy it because I don't want to carry my bag around. And so I want that kind of seamless integration. And I expect it is, and I will go to the client, to the retailer that has that.
Yes. That's very true. So clients vote with their feet, basically, right?
Absolutely.
So and that's right. So that's why I think, you know, some of the retailers which really are getting this. You do have some in Japan. I mean, a brand like Fast Retailing, for example, the success they're enjoying is linked to them being pioneers, being able to bring in technology to support their core business, being really good at what they're doing. You don't reach that kind of success, 2,500 stores right now worldwide, without being on top of your game. So you do have some examples, but I would say the vast majority of the retail environment in Japan is still very much local. Knows that they have to do something, but don't necessarily yet grasp all the aspects of it. And so COVID somehow has stopped, you know, people going outside of Japan trying to see what was happening. And the world moved very quickly, actually, during those 3 years. So now that the borders are reopened, I'm trying to get my prospects, my customers, to go and see what's happening. And, you know, we were in New York. There is the largest trade show for retail, which is in New York, actually, and the NRF in early January. The number of Japanese delegations we hosted was mind-boggling. And everybody was looking and say, wow, is that really existing? Is that the video? No, it's actual live store. You can do that? Yes, we can. And you can do it as well. So, sure. But I think, you know, time stood a bit still in Japan for the last 3 years. But now everybody's realizing, like, ooh, we need to catch up. And we need to do so quickly. And I have high hopes, because I know that when the Japanese get in order, they can move, and they can move very, very, very quickly. They take time to decide. But once everything is done, it will happen. It will happen quickly.
Yeah, traditionally, we're very good at that. We take a lot of time to decide. We measure not twice, not three times, but like 70 times and cut once, but we get there. What for you, what's the biggest challenge you're facing?
I think there's one you're going to love, which is how to build a good team to actually operate and be efficient at the level we need to be at. Not saying this because of your profession, David, but it's really because it's something I believe in. There is we have this saying that in the richesse que d'homme, there is only wealth but in men. And it's really that. And you know how hard it is, especially for foreign businesses, to be able to find that kind of the right mindset, the right person with the social skills, the competencies, the cultural fits. It's so complicated. And to just have everybody bind together, especially, you know, when you're not, let's say, a Microsoft, a Google, or you don't have such a brand name, you're more on a B2B with less visibility, is why would people join you? What are you offering? So it's always a challenge, an interesting one. But without this, there is no development, there is no growth, there is nothing. So for me, that's the most important one right now. And of course, after that, you know, convincing the client, bringing them on board, delivery, etc. I wouldn't say this is mechanical, because there are some local peculiarities linked to the Japanese market, the need to localize language, UI, UX, etc. But once again, nothing impossible, as long as you know how you keep your DNA, how you keep your core, and then you adapt. But to do so, you need to have people who can do the bridge, who can bridge that gap. And that's complicated, because if you don't have these people, you're going to fail. And unfortunately, the history of 30 years for foreign company entering the Japanese market it's actually quite long.
Yeah.
So, for me, it boils down to people.
It's interesting. I mean, there is it's a candidate short market. And so it's very difficult to find good talent for companies across the board, right? But then you start looking at individuals that are looking now. I find that the younger folks tend to be risk averse and commercially averse and internationally averse compared to 20 years ago, where younger people at that time wanted to join international companies, wanted to go overseas, were happy to join startups because of the international or the fast growth. And now I see a very large aversion to that. And that makes it even more difficult for SMEs and foreign SMEs specifically in Japan, that it just wasn't that way 20 years ago.
Mm.
It was hard to find bilingual people, granted. Yeah. But now you might find some bilingual people, but they don't want to jump ship into a foreign SME. And I hear what you're saying, and that challenge of building up that strong focused team is a challenge that a lot of companies are going to continue facing in Japan.
I think it's going to get worse and worse because of the population decrease, basically. So the available pool is going to decrease sharply. And then that means also that the opportunities for the candidates you were mentioning is going to increase also very sharply, because everybody's going to go after them. So they will have a huge range of options. Salaries, et cetera, have been kept actually quite low. Mm-hmm. Everything considered equal over the years by the big companies, right? Mm-hmm. And I can see it's starting to change, right? Some of the key guys, just to recruit, for example, in IT or elsewhere, were offering startups starting salaries which were higher than the department head. Yeah. Because of his skill set. So, which is something very common, I would say, in the West, but in Japan was very, very hard to go through that barrier. And this is gone already, because if you want the competence, you have to pay for that. And people have a choice. I think it was, what, 3 positions open in IT for one person. It's like, how are you going to build a sustainable organization with that? How are you going to build loyalty? What kind of, what is the dream also of the new generation, right? What do they want to do? Do they want to work really as hard as their parents or grandparents? What are the key drivers they want? You know, things are changing. And I can see that very, very sharply. So if you're not relevant, or what you're offering is not on par with what this generation is looking, you're going to be in big, big, big trouble. And that encompasses so development plan, your Japanese-ness, your life-work balance, the kind of why the office. You want to do all full remote, or do you still want to come to the office? If you come to the office, what's the value of the office? Just like bringing people to the store, right? If I can do my shopping online, why do you have to come, you know, to the store to do my purchase? So if I can work at my place, why do I have to come to the office? You have to bring something more. It has to be fun. It has to be value added. It has to be a nice environment, but we have to rethink. And I think in Japan, it's so hard. Because the traditional model, I mean, you go and walk on an open space with everybody lined up, and then the kakaricho, and then the bucho, and then, oh my God, feels like the army.
But one of the positive things is it's driving diversity, and yes, it's giving opportunities to people who didn't have opportunities. It's allowing foreigners to enter into the Japan market and into roles that traditionally were not available. So that drives creativity and change, which I find is exciting, because some companies will embrace that.
I agree. Women in the workforce as well. For me, it's going to be the main key driver of the change. Frankly speaking, with I love working with Japanese women managers at my clients, because usually they're far much better than their counterparts. Yeah. By all accounts, they had to fight far much more. They had to be smarter. They had to be more efficient. They know what they want, usually, and it makes it far much, you know, easier, smoother. And you know, it's severely undertapped market in Japan. There's huge competencies around the block, but everybody, you know, wants women want to go back on a, if they had children, when they want to go back, they've been, let's put that word out, mistreated.
Yeah,
I think it's unbelievable the loss. I mean, there's competent people willing to work with highly motivated, but you're not giving them freedom. You're not giving them responsibility just because they walked out of the market for a few years. What are we talking about? Makes no sense. What kind of society is sustainable if you're just discarding half of your population because of that?
Lack of trust. I have one story where I had a candidate who joined a company, Western company, very domestic inside, wasn't told, said it was very diverse company inside, but you know, she has children and responsibilities, and this happens with both men and women, but just parents in general with other responsibilities and want the flexibility, and have found we are going back to 5 days, 6 days a week in the office, 10-12 if you're in finance and accounting, it's you know, you've got closing, we want you in the office. A lot of bad systems, like you'd mentioned, these things will change. And I think employees will vote with their feet, which is a wonderful image. Like, yeah, they'll say, okay, I can go somewhere else. Per hour, I might get a little less money, but per life, it's huge. So,
exactly.
Speaking of time, I got a couple of things I want to get through. First, sure. is about time. You have a obsessive compulsive collecting habit, I hear.
The cat is out.
So if anybody wants to start a collection, call Pascal. So what do you collect, Pascal?
Yes, so I've been collecting watches for quite some time, actually. So a little bit of a fascination with time and clockwork. You know, the beauty of being able to display something which is passing like time on your wrist. I find it fascinating. And as an engineer as well, all the mechanics behind this, you know, and all the key elements of clockwork have been designed when computer were not existing. And we haven't done really that much better since, 400 years ago. So, yeah, it's a little bit of an expensive habit of mine on that end.
What's your key timepiece?
I'm very much into Cartier, I would say. I love it. It's the most, let's say, French of the Swiss brand. And, you know, I wear my flag on the heart. So as a Frenchman,
I had William Neely, just a little bit of a pitch. I had a William Neely from Cartier on my show a few months ago. So yeah, Cartier, wonderful. And
yes, and not very well known, actually, especially in that field for men watches. But it's one of the pioneers, actually, in that field. It's also what I like about it. You know, they had started one of the first wristwatches for men, or sports watch, whatever it was, the Cartier Santos Dumont. And it was designed in 1904, if I'm not mistaken, for Alberto Santos Dumont, who was one of the pioneers in the aviation, you know, plane. He was running, developing planes as a Brazilian in Paris. And that's how he met Louis Cartier at that time. And what I love about them is they've been really pioneering new design, new ideas, incorporating also global ideas into specific something new. And you know, the motto of Louis Cartier was always create, never copy. And I find it extremely relevant up to this day. And that's also why I love them. And that talks about, you know, it's something It talks about the person, right? If you're wearing a Rolex, 100% gold, yellow gold Rolex, tell something about you.
Yeah.
If you're wearing a Cartier Saint-Simon, it will tell something different. You're not the same person.
Nice.
And your persona might change, you know, over the years or even within a week or even et cetera, but it's still something different. And for me, that's pretty much in line with my values or what I try to do. And that's why I love the brand that much.
You always have class and suave whenever I'm with you, Pascal. So we're going to end with some rapid fire questions to see how suave you come out. I've picked out some I think that are relevant for you. What is your favorite word in another language?
My favorite word. Ooh, that is a very challenging question because now you're forcing me to choose out of at least eight. Okay, I will answer. It might not be what you were expecting. But I will say that it's Angelina, because it's the name of my daughter.
Oh, I love it. That's brilliant.
And I spent actually a bit of time being of a French and Chinese actually ascent, so that it can be used. There is an angel. There is a lot of signification, and my family is important for me to be that. That's the most important word for me.
Good. That's a beautiful word, and keep on uttering that. What's your favorite breakfast?
being a French guy involved in in bakery, croissant. Nice. More pain au chocolat. That's a pain au chocolat. Wow. Chocolate pain.
Now I'm getting hungry. Favorite type of weather?
The weather we got in Tokyo just when it's turning into the sakura season. You know, it's just beautiful. And blue sky is very deep. And then all this beautiful, the air is changing, season is changing, you know, everything is reviving. Perfect. And definitely not the Japanese summer.
Mushiatsu, not for you. Morning or evening?
Definitely evening.
Salty or sweet?
Ooh, now you got me on that one. Moving more towards salt as I grow older.
Okay. Yeah, me too, but I have to go with my last name, don't I? do you watch shows one episode at a time or binge watch a whole season?
Depends on the length of a season. There are only 24 hours in a day, right? But yeah, binge would be more than.
Superpowers, would you fly or have super strength?
Flying. Definitely.
Do you kill bugs or do you take them outside?
Depends on the bugs.
Okay. And would you rather travel to the past or the future?
Huh. Well, that's also a very difficult question. With the kind of future which is brewing up right now, I'm thinking traveling to the past might be a little bit safer. To some extent.
But you go back to Nara Jedi with your sword and see how that fares
exactly.
Out for you. Well, fantastic. It's been wonderful to chat with you today, Pascal. You're always insightful. I learned a lot about culture and sword fighting in your business, and I love talking about Japan business with you, and thank you so much. Where is the best place for people to reach out to you if they want to talk about swords or business?
I am on several different platforms. You can try me on LinkedIn. I'd say would be probably the most visible one. Instagram, you can send me a request, but I would recommend LinkedIn probably.
Right. And we'll put links to that in the show notes. And please... be wonderful and give Focus Core a 5-star rating wherever you listen to our podcast. Again, thank you, Pascal. It was nice chatting.
Thanks, David. Thanks very much. Thanks to Focus Core for hosting me. Thank you.
I'm doing the uptown lowdown, yeah.